I am Daniel Hughes.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Now, Music 101 is created to empower music itself, and legendary icon in the music industry. Mob Pops versus Teen Idols, The British Invasion, and How American Artists Revolutionized Music, Part 1.
Yes, indeed. You know, the British Invasion of 1964 didn't simply introduce new bands to American audiences. It fundamentally rewired the creative DNA of American pop and rock music. When the Beatles, Rolling Stones, and their compatriots stormed the charts, they forced American artists to reconsider everything from instrumentation and songwriting to image and artistic ambition. This episode explores how established and emerging American musicians responded to this seismic shift, tracing the evolution of sounds, careers, and creative philosophies that would define the decade and beyond.
Decade and beyond. Well, let's start at the ground zero. Mr. Mack, when the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan in February 1964, what was the immediate impact on American artists who were already established?
Well, you know, it was absolutely devastating for some artists and galvanizing for others. Consider someone like Bobby V, who had been riding high with teen-oriented pop hits like Take Good Care of My Baby. Almost overnight, his brand of clean-cut orchestrated pop felt antiquated. The same happened to artists like Fabian, Frankie Avalon, and much of the Philadelphia sound that had dominated the early 1960s. The Beatles were a self-contained band that wrote its own material, played its own instruments, and projected authentic youth rebellion, and that became the new standard. But here's where it gets interesting. Some American artists saw this as a challenge to rise to. The Beach Boys are the perfect example. Brian Wilson lit a competitive fire under him, and hearing Rubber Soul in December 1965 changed everything for him. He realized the album could be an artistic statement, not just a collection of singles. This directly led to Pet Sounds. It's one of the most influential albums in rock history. You can hear the shift happening in real time. Compare the demo of Surfin' USA from 1963 with God Only Knows from 1966. It's almost hard to believe it's the same band. And, you know, the folk artists had a different reaction entirely. Dylan, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Joan Baez, they initially viewed the British Invasion with suspicion. These were serious artists dealing with social and political themes, civil rights, war, and social justice. And from there, the Beatles singing, I Want to Hold Your Hand, seemed trivial by comparison. But what they didn't immediately recognize was that the British bands, particularly the Beatles and the Animals, were deeply influenced by American folk and blues traditions. The Animals' House of the Rising Sun was an electrified version of a traditional folk song, and it became a massive hit in 1964. The Animals' arrangement, with its driving electric guitar and dramatic organ, showed folk artists like Dylan that there was a way to maintain lyrical depth while embracing the power and reach of rock instrumentation. In conclusion, the British Invasion created an immediate divide in American music artists who could adapt and evolve and found new creative heights, while those who couldn't or wouldn't found themselves increasingly marginalized as relics of a bygone era.
Mr. Mick, speaking of Dylan, his move to electric music is probably the most famous example of an American artist responding to the British invasion. What really happened there?
Well, the story of Dylan going electric is one of the most dramatic and most misunderstood episodes in rock history. On July 25th, 1965, at the Newport Folk Festival, Dylan walked on stage with an electric guitar and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band and played a loud, amplified set. The audience reaction was mixed. Some cheered, some booed, and the folk purists felt betrayed. Pete Seeger reportedly tried to cut the sound cables with an axe, though that story may be apocryphal. Dylan had been watching the British bands what they were doing very carefully. The Beatles were massive Dylan fans. They met in August 1964, and Dylan introduced them to marijuana during that famous encounter. When the Animals took House of the Rising Sun to number one with their electric arrangement, Dylan saw the template. He actually recorded House of the Rising Sun himself on his first album in 1962 as a traditional folk acoustic piece, and the contrast with the Animals' version was stark. Dylan's Electric Trilogy, bringing it all home, back home, Highway 61 Revisited, and Blonde on Blonde, all released between March 1965 and May 1966, represents perhaps the greatest artistic hot streak in rock history. And with that, songs like Subterranean Homesick Blues combine his surrealistic wordplay with Chuck Berry-style rock and roll. Like a Rolling Stone, married a scathing social commentary to an organ-driven rock sound that was impossible to ignore. At over 6 minutes, it broke the three-minute single format and became a number two, proof that American audiences were ready for something more substantial than simple love songs. The Byrds saw the same opportunity and created folk rock almost simultaneously with Dylan's pivot. Mr. Tambourine Man in April 1965 took a Dylan song and gave it a Beatles-influenced arrangement. Suddenly, folk rock was a genre, and artists like Simon and Garfunkel, who'd broken up after their acoustic debut flop, reunited when their producer Tom Wilson overdubbed Electric Instruments onto their acoustic recording of The Sound of Silence without their knowledge. It became a number one hit in January 1966, and their career was reborn. In conclusion, Dylan's electric transformation wasn't a betrayal of folk music's principles, but rather an evolution that allowed those principles to reach the generation that needed to hear the most.
Evolution indeed. And how did the soul and R&B artists respond, Mr. Mac? Were they affected differently than the folk and pop artists?
That's a fascinating angle. Berry Gordy at Motown was absolutely paying attention, and he adjusted his approach strategically. Gordy noticed that the British bands were raw, more energetic, and their audiences responded to that vitality. So we see Motown artists gradually incorporating more rock elements. The Temptations, Papa Was a Rolling Stone in 1972, shows the culmination of that evolution. It's a 12-minute psychedelic soul epic that would have been unthinkable in 1963. Even earlier, you can hear the shift. Compare the Supremes' Where Did Our Love Go from 1964 with their later, more rock-influenced material. Diana Ross and the Ladies were always Motown, but Love Is Like an Itching in My Heart has the least sweetened feel, their most rhythmic aggression, and the closest thing to rock urgency in their catalog. Stax Records in Memphis took a different approach. Otis Redding's performance at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, the same festival where Jimi Hendrix set his guitar on fire, showed that raw, emotional soul could hold its own against any British or psychedelic rock act. His version of Respect from 1965, later famously covered by Aretha Franklin in 1967, demonstrated that soul music didn't need to imitate British rock. But here's the irony that soul artists were keenly aware of. Many British invasion bands were heavily influenced by American music. The Rolling Stones took their song from Muddy Waters' song and covered Chuck Berry, Willie Dixon, and Solomon Burke. The Animals, Eric Burdon, even recorded with War, a funk and soul band, later in his career. So in some sense, the British invasion was American soul and blues being filtered through British sensibilities and sent back across the Atlantic with a different accent. This led to some productive cross-pollination. Wilson Pickett recorded Hey Jude in 1968 with the Allman Brothers' Duane Allman on guitar, giving the Beatles' ballad a funky Southern soul treatment. Stevie Wonder covered the Beatles' We Can Work It Out in 1971, completely transforming it with his harmonics and groove. Atlantic Records, with producers like Jerry Wexler, actively worked to position in soul artists as the real thing compared to British imitators. Aretha Franklin's arrival at Atlantic in 1967 was perfectly timed. Her version of Respect became not just a hit, but a cultural statement about authenticity and empowerment. In conclusion, while soul and R&B artists faced less of an existential threat from the British invasion than pop artists, they still had to navigate a landscape where British bands were getting mainstream success by covering American music, leading them to assert their authenticity more forcefully.
Mr. Mick, the mid-1960s saw an explosion of American GarageBand. What is the direct response to the British invasion showing that young people could form the bands that make the music?
The British invasion democratized rock and roll in a way that nothing else had. When American teenagers saw the Beatles and the Stones, young guys not much older than themselves, playing guitars and drums, the message was clear. You don't need to be a trained musician or have a record deal to start a band. All you need is some instruments, a garage to practice in, and attitude. This led to an explosion of regional garage rock bands across America between 1964 and 1968. The Sonics from Tacoma, Washington are a perfect example. Their 1965 recording, Psycho, is pure primal energy. Distorted guitar, pounding drums, and screaming vocals that influenced punk rock a decade before punk existed. They weren't trying to be polished or professional. They were trying to be exciting and loud, which is exactly what teenagers wanted. The Kingsmen from Portland, Oregon had already shown the template with Louie Louie in 1963, but that song truly exploded in popularity after the British invasion proved that raw, barely competent rock and roll could dominate the charts. What's remarkable is how regionally diverse this garage rock movement was. Question Mark and the Mysterians from Michigan gave us 96 Tears in 1966, featuring that unforgettable Farfisa organ. The Seeds from Los Angeles created primitive but hypnotic garage psych with Pushin' Too Hard in 1966. The Shadows of Night from Chicago covered Them's Gloria in 1966 and somehow made it even rawer than Van Morrison's original. Count Five from San Jose hit with Psychotic Reaction in 1966, complete with that famous fuzz-tone guitar solo that sounded like a chainsaw cutting through metal. American garage bands felt emboldened to be raw, loud, and aggressive. They didn't need strings, they didn't need sophisticated production, they needed energy and hooks. The compilation album Nuggets, Original Artifacts from the First Psychedelic Era, 1965 to 1968, assembled by Lenny Kaye in 1972, who later became Patti Smith's guitarist, rescued many of these recordings from obscurity and created a canon of garage rock classics. Songs like The Standells' Dirty Water and The Electric Prunes' I Had Too Much to Dream Last Night and The Music Machines' Talk Talk all shared that same DNA. Simple chord progressions, fuzzy guitars, and vocals that prioritize attitude over technique. The legacy of garage rock cannot be overstated. In conclusion, the British invasion inadvertently sparked an American garage rock movement that would become more influential over time than many of the British bands that inspired it.
By 1966 and 1967, American rock was heading into psychedelic territory. How did the evolution emerge from this British invasion, Mr. Meg?
The psychedelic movement is where American artists truly seized the creative initiative back from the British bands. While the Beatles were experimenting with psychedelia on Revolver and Sgt. Pepper's, American bands on the West Coast, particularly in San Francisco, were creating a distinctly American psychedelic sound rooted in folk rock, blues, and the emerging countercultural. The Grateful Dead are the quintessential example. The Dead's approach to psychedelia was about extended improvisational jamming rooted in American musical traditions. Listen to Dark Star from 1968. It's a 23-minute journey that combines modal jazz, space rock, and blues into something uniquely American. Jefferson Airplane took a different approach. Grace Slick brought art school sophistication and powerful female vocals to songs like White Rabbit and Somebody to Love, both from 1967. The Doors, based in Los Angeles rather than San Francisco, created yet another American psychedelic variant. Jim Morrison's shamanistic poetry combined with Ray Manzarek's Baroque organ and Robbie Krieger's flamenco-influenced guitar created a dark, literary psychedelia that was miles away from the Beatles' Sunny, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Through the Doors, music had its own darkness, of course. The End, from 1967 debut album, is an 11-minute Oedipal nightmare that Francis Ford Coppola famously used in Apocalypse Now. You simply can't imagine a British band making that particular piece of music at that time. Even established artists adopted psychedelia to their strengths. The Byrds, who started as a folk rock group, evolved into psychedelic and then country rock. Their 1966 single, 8 Miles High, featured Roger McGinn's raga-influenced guitar playing, inspired by John Coltrane's saxophone and Ravi Shankar's sitar. It was psychedelic, but built on jazz and Indian classical music rather than simply copying what the Beatles were doing with sitars. Love, led by Arthur Lee, created Baroque psychedelic masterpieces like the album Forever Changes in 1967. Songs like Alone Again or combine mariachi horns, acoustic guitars, and Lee's falsetto vocals into something that sounded like nothing else in rock music, certainly nothing like British bands were making. Lee was one of the most challenging artists in the psychedelic rock scene, and he brought a different sensibility and set of influences. The difference between American and British psychedelia often came down to scale and pace. British psychedelia, constrained by smaller venues and shorter traditions of improvisation, tended towards concise, carefully constructed studio creations. American psychedelia, especially on the West Coast, sprawled out. Longer songs, looser structures, more improvisation, more influenced by jazz and blues traditions that valued spontaneity. When the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, and Janis Joplin with Big Brother and the Holding Company performed at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, they showed the world that American psychedelia was a live experience, not just a studio construction. In conclusion, while the British invasion planted the seeds of psychedelic experimentation, American artists cultivated a distinctly American psychedelic garden that drew from deeper roots in folk, blues, and jazz, ultimately creating something that British bands couldn't replicate.
Well said, Mr. Mick. By the late 1960s, we start seeing the emergence of the singer-songwriting or songwriter movement with the artists like James Taylor and Carole King. How does it fit into this narrative of American artists responding to the British invasion?
The singer-songwriter movement represents a uniquely American response to the British invasion that went in the opposite direction from psychedelia and garage rock, towards intimacy and personal confession. This movement was in many ways a return to folk music's emphasis on lyrical storytelling, but now informed by everything that had happened in rock music over the previous 6 years. Carole King is a perfect example of this evolution. She'd been a hugely successful brill-building songwriter in the early 1960s, writing hits like Will You Love Me Tomorrow for the Shirelles in 1960 and The Locomotion for Little Eva in 1962. These were classic pre-British invasion pop songs, professional songwriters crafting material for other performers to record. But the British invasion, especially the Beatles, established the expectation that artists should write and perform their own material. When King finally emerged as a solo performer with Tapestry in 1971, she brought that brill-building craftsmanship to deeply personal songs like It's Too Late and You've Got a Friend. With this, we see that the album then spent 15 weeks at number one and sold over 25 million copies, proof that after years of loud experimental rock, audiences craved intimacy and emotional directness. James Taylor similarly emerged from the folk tradition, but was unexpectedly shaped by the British invasion. He was actually signed to Apple Records, the Beatles label, in 1968, making him the first non-British artist on their roster. His 1970 album, Sweet Baby James, featured songs like Fire and Rain and Country Road that were intensely personal, dealing with his struggles with depression and addiction. And with that, we start to see that the production was clean and understated. No psychedelic effects, no distortion, just beautiful melodies and confessional lyrics. This was revolutionary in its own way, vulnerability as artistic statement. Joni Mitchell took the singer-songwriter form to its highest artistic peak. Starting with folk albums like Song to a Seagull, 1968, she evolved into increasingly complex musical and lyrical territory. By Blue in 1971, she was creating confessional masterpieces like A Case of You that made personal pain and romantic complexity the subject of serious art. Mitchell's guitar playing used alternative tunings that she developed herself, creating harmonic textures that were sophisticated without being showy. She was clearly influenced by the Beatles' experimental spirit. She incorporated jazz musicians and complex arrangements in later albums, but her core approach was about stripping away pretense and revealing emotional truth. Paul Simon, after Simon and Garfunkel split in 1970, pursued an increasingly personal and musically adventurous path. His self-titled 1972 album included Mother and Child Reunion, which he recorded in Jamaica with reggae musicians, showing that singer-songwriters didn't have to limit themselves to acoustic guitars and pianos. But even as he experimented with different sounds, the focus remained on crafted songs with literary lyrics. Neil Young represented another variant of the singer-songwriter. Coming from Buffalo Springfield, which had been influenced by both British invasion bands and American folk rock, Young's solo work combined raw, emotional vocals with a willingness to be musically adventurous. Heart of Gold from 1972 became his only number one hit, a gentle, melodic folk rock song that showed vulnerability could be commercially successful. But Young also could make abrasive electric albums like Tonight's the Night, 1975, when the mood struck him, refusing to be limited by singer-songwriter conventions. The singer-songwriter movement also opened doors for female artists in unprecedented ways. Before the British invasion, female performers were largely interpreters of songs written by others. But the new paradigm valued authentic self-expression, and women like King, Mitchell, Laura Nero, and Carly Simon proved they could write, perform, and produce their own material at the highest level. Carly Simon's You're So Vain from 1972 was both a commercial smash and a sophisticated, ambiguous piece of songwriting that could hold up to any analysis. What's often overlooked is how this movement was specifically an American phenomenon. British singer-songwriters certainly existed, Donovan, Cat Stevens, Elton John, but the confessional intimacy and the connection to American folk and country traditions made the American singer-songwriter movement distinct. These artists were drawing on Woody Guthrie, Hank Williams, and the folk revival in ways that British artists couldn't authentically access. In conclusion, the singer-songwriter movement showed that American artists could respond to the British invasion not by trying to be louder or more experimental, but by going deeper into personal truth and emotional honesty, territories where authenticity mattered more than virtuosity.
Honesty indeed. So, Mr. Mick, as we begin to wrap up, let's talk about the heavier side of things. How did American artists help develop hard rock and heavy metal in response of the parallel with the British bands like Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath?
Well, this is where things get really interesting, because hard rock and heavy metal have complex and intertwined American and British origins. While British bands like Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, and Deep Purple often get credit for inventing heavy metal, American artists were absolutely crucial to the development and popularization of heavy metal. First, let's acknowledge that British heavy rock bands were deeply influenced by American blues artists. Led Zeppelin's entire approach was built on electric blues from Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, and Willie Dixon. Artists Robert Plant and Jimmy Page studied intensely. So in some sense, British heavy rock was American music being transformed and amplified. But American artists didn't just sit back and let the British own the heavy sound. Jimi Hendrix is the obvious starting point, even though he had to go to England first to find success. Hendrix was from Seattle, played in R&B and soul bands backing Little Richard and the Isley Brothers, and couldn't get a record deal in America. But when he went to London in 1966 and formed the Jimi Hendrix Experience with British musicians Noel Redding and Mitch Mitchell, he created a new template for what the electric guitar could do. Purple Haze from 1967 featured distortion, feedback, and a tritone interval, the Devil's Interval, that would become metal's calling card. His performance at Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, where he lit his guitar on fire, and at Woodstock in 1969, when he played the Star Spangled Banner as a screaming, feedback-drenched protest against the Vietnam War, showed that American artists could take rock volume and aggression to places British bands hadn't imagined. But beyond Hendrix, American bands were developing their own heavy sounds. Steppenwolf, featuring German-born but California-based John Kay, gave us Born to Be Wild in 1968, the song that literally contains the phrase heavy metal thunder and appeared in Easy Rider, linking motorcycle culture, counterculture rebellion, and loud rock music. Blue Cheer, a San Francisco power trio, recorded Summertime Blues in 1968 with such crushing volume and distortion that it makes many later bands sound polite. They've often been called proto-metal or proto-punk, and they were absolutely American. Iron Butterfly's Inagata De Vita from 1968 was a 17-minute epic with a heavy, repetitive riff and an extended drum solo that showed American bands could be just as bombastic and excessive as any British group. The album sold over 30 million copies, proving there was a massive American audience for heavy, extended rock music. As we move into the 1970s, American hard rock diversifies. Grand Funk Railroad became one of the biggest American rock bands despite critical disdain, packing stadiums with straightforward blues-based hard rock. Their cover of Locomotion in 1974 took Carole King's pop song and made it a hard rock stomper, showing how American bands could recontextualize pre-British invasion material through a heavy lens. Mountain, featuring guitarist Leslie West, created heavy blues rock that influenced countless later metal bands. Mississippi Queen from 1970 is a masterclass in heavy riffing and cowbell before Saturday Night Live made cowbell a joke. West's tone and approach to heavy blues guitar created a template that American metal would build on. The American Allman Brothers Band, based in Georgia, created a uniquely American heavy rock by fusing blues, jazz, and southern rock. Their live album, At Fillmore East 1971, features extended improvisations like Whipping Post that show you didn't need distortion and power chords to create heavy, powerful rock music. You could do that with dual lead guitars, jazz-influenced drumming, and blues intensity. Dwayne Allman's slide guitar on songs like Statesboro Blues proved that American blues traditions could generate as much power as any British riff. And by the mid-1970s, American hard rock and proto-metal were exploding in various directions. Aerosmith emerged from Boston with a raw blues-based sound that drew equally from the Rolling Stones and American blues. Dream On from their 1973 debut showcased Steven Tyler's powerful vocals and Joe Perry's guitar work, while later songs like Walk This Way showed they could create heavy funk rock grooves. But even Kiss took American hard rock and added theatrical spectacle, creating a uniquely American phenomenon. Their live shows with fire breathing, blood spitting, and elaborate costumes were pure American excess, more P.T. Barnum than British blues. Songs like Rock and Roll All Night became anthems for a generation of American kids who wanted rock music to be fun, loud, and larger than life. Kiss understood something crucial in America. Presentation and spectacle matter as much as musicianship. Ted Nugent represented a more aggressive Guitar Hero approach to American hard rock. His Motor City sound on songs like Cat Scratch Fever combined heavy riffs with his wild man stage persona, creating an archetype of American hard rock as primal, masculine, and aggressive. While British bands often get credited with inventing heavy metal, American artists were essential in developing heavy rock's various forms. From Hendrix's psychedelic heaviness to the Allman Brothers' jazz blues power to Kiss's theatrical hard rock, creating distinctly American approaches to loud, aggressive music that would influence metal, punk, and alternative rock for decades to come. The 1960s were a transformative era in popular music, marked by the clash and convergence of distinct musical forces. On one side were the Mop Tops, epitomized by the Beatles and other British invasion bands, who brought fresh energy, innovative sounds, and a new cultural swagger to the American music scene. On the other side were the teen idols, predominantly American artists who had dominated previously. The British invasion jolted American teen idols from their comfort zone, forcing them to adapt or fade away. Many teen idols either declined or transformed into more serious artists. For instance, artists like Elvis Presley, himself a precursor to both teen idols and rock legends, embraced more experimental sounds and socially conscious lyrics as the decade progressed. More importantly, American artists revolutionized music by blending British influences with indigenous genres such as soul, rhythm and blues, and folk. This synthesis gave birth to new forms like psychedelic rock, funk, and eventually soul-infused rock. Bands like The Byrds merged folk rock with British pop sensibilities, while Motown artists like Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder pushed boundaries of lyrical depth and music complexity within pop frameworks. American songwriters like Bob Dylan also redefined the cultural role of music by using lyrics as social commentary, a move that inspired British bands to write more meaningful content. This transatlantic exchange elevated popular music from mere entertainment to a form of artistic expression with social resonance. By the 1970s, these movements democratized music making, encouraged artistic authenticity, and expanded popular music cultural influence. The legacy of this symbiosis is still evident today in how artists around the world innovate by blending diverse influences while maintaining their roots. In conclusion, while American teen idols played an important role in paving the way for youth-oriented popular music, it was the mop tops of the British invasion who truly revolutionized the musical landscape. But then the Americans got busy and were pushed to greater musical heights, leaving us with more to explore in part two of this series. So stay tuned.
Yes, Mr. Mink, we're looking for that, for the part two itself. And thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. Mop Tops versus Teen Idols, the British Invasion and How American Artists Revolutionized Music, part one explores a defining moment when music become more than entertainment. It become a cultural transformation itself. So, Mr. Mink, would you like to plug in something?
I appreciate the opportunity. Connect with me on LinkedIn. Write the book, Grow the Business. G. Mink, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD. Listen to a couple of volumes that I have on Amazon. That is On Track, Ian Hunter, and Burning America. Also listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast. And if you love music, support true fans.
Indeed, people, let's support Mr. Mink, the Doctor Digital, and of course our four podcasts, 611, Mental Health 101, and Love Letters, as well as Music 101. So, Mr. Mink, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Till next time, stay useful.
What do you got, people? See you soon.